Welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, which may not be possible in this episode, to be quite frank with you, we'll try and find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. This is one of those podcasts that, believe it or not, even though I will be speaking, I am nearly at a loss for words on what to present to all of you, those that follow this program and have supported it for the last 3 years, and I appreciate that very much. I make every attempt. It may not seem like it at times. I make every attempt to literally find sense in the senseless, and if at all possible, to dig out the obvious lessons buried in the absurdities of life. And I just don't know that that's possible in this episode. The whole world, of course, has watched Afghanistan implode on itself, and the repercussions of that here in the States for those of us who have watched this for 20 years, because it's been in and out of the news for all those times. It's senseless. There's no way to add this up. The only thing that kept coming to mind over and over the past week as I watched these news reports was how far apart expectation and reality really are. You know, we expect things to be a certain way, and we live with that. And then, of course, the reality is they are something very different. And the gap in between the two of those things, expectation and reality, is where most of the suffering occurs in the world and in our lives. So the reality is that after 20 years and trillions of dollars spent, it's kind of hard to find anything that was worth it. And I bring this up from a casual observer, from a bystander. I don't have any inside information on, you know, all the comings and goings and the whereabouts and the withdrawal of what went on there any more than any of you do. All we get to see is the backside of all this. And I remember, as we come up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 shortly, you know, what that felt like. And I was on the air for 3 hours that day. And actually, I was on for like five, I think it was. Interestingly enough, back on 9/11, Rush Limbaugh, who was on the same station I was on back in the day, he was off and they had a fill-in and the guy was terrible. And so they cut him off and said, you go back on, even though I was only supposed to 3 hours, ended up doing probably five or six, like I said. And so when I drove home, I saw the churches were full, the parking lots were full of all these places, and the flags were, you know, some of them were at half mast. There was just this pall over Michigan where I lived. And I remember getting home and playing catch with my son Andy in the yard. It was the one normal thing I could do that made me feel like it was like there'd be a tomorrow, odd as that may sound. So 20 years later, you know, when I see images of these C-130s taking off and humans clinging to them to get out of there, my mind immediately rewinds back to 1973 when I was going into high school and the fall of Saigon and seeing those helicopters with the chain of humans trying to get on. And maybe the obvious buried in the absurd of that is that even though the years roll by, humans don't change very much. We just don't. This is like an ongoing slog in human behavior modification, and it's very difficult. There's more of us than there's ever been before. We are pushed together and smashed together in ways we never have with all this technology. And I don't know that, you know, as I've always said, when you squeeze oranges, you get orange juice. You squeeze tomatoes, you usually get tomato juice or ketchup. But if you squeeze humans, all kind of shit comes out. And we keep squeezing ourselves and each other closer and closer together. And you would think, with the advent of the internet and all the availability we have to information and education, that we'd become a far more enlightened species. And that's not the effing case, sad as it is. So the last few days as this has unfolded, pulling back from whatever's going on at the White House and the Pentagon and all that stuff, those plans, I started thinking about the only two real connections that I have to Afghanistan and Iraq, which at one point was kind of one big war fought on two places. And I started to think about the two people that I know, one far better than the other, who paid the ultimate price because their sons didn't come home. But before I get to that, I wanted to share this, which I thought was extremely well done. And if I could write something that would sum up a little bit of what's been going on for 20 years, this is how I would put it. So this is from the Associated Press, August 17th of 2021. Ellen Nickmeyer did some of the work. And then there is data from Linda Blimes of Harvard University's Kennedy School and from the Brown University Cost of War Project. So these are the things that I can take a few minutes to spend on that does not explain it all. I don't even know if it helps understand it all, but it needs to be put out there because this is what perspective is for me. These are the things that get lost, I think, in translation sometimes, certainly lost in the news cycle. You might hear some background music as a disclaimer. Music meaning the guy next door's frickin' lawnmower. But I've been waiting on him for 20 minutes, and if he comes back out again, I'm going to continue on. So there you go with that. Ellen Nickmeyer writes, at just short of 20 years, the now-ending U.S. combat mission in Afghanistan was America's longest war. Ordinary Americans tended to forget about it, and it received measurably less oversight from Congress than the Vietnam War did. But its death toll is in the many tens of thousands, and because the U.S. borrowed most of the money to pay for it, generations of Americans will be burdened by the cost of paying it off. Here's a look at the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan by the numbers, as the Taliban, in a lightning offensive, took over much of the country before the United States' August 31st deadline for ending its combat role, and the U.S. speeds up American and Afghan evacuations even as I speak. So as I mentioned, much of this data is from Linda Blimes at Harvard University's Kennedy School and from the Brown University Cost of War Projects. Because the United States between 2003 and 2011 fought the Afghanistan and Iraq wars simultaneously, and many American troops served in tours in both wars, some of the figures, as noted, cover both post-9/11 U.S. wars. So just know that going in. The percentage of U.S. population born since the 2001 attacks plotted by al-Qaeda leaders who were sheltering in Afghanistan, roughly one out of every four. One more time on this. The percentage of U.S. population born since 2001 attacks, 9/11, plotted by al-Qaeda leaders who were sheltering in Afghanistan, one out of four. So that means one out of four people in this country were not there on 9/11 and know what happened and how this all went down and the ripple effect that that it had on us. The human cost. American service members killed in Afghanistan through April of this year, 2,448. U.S. contractors, 3,846. Afghan National Military and Police, 66,000. Other allied service members, including from NATO member states, 1,144. Afghan civilians killed, 47,245. Taliban and other opposition fighters, confirmed kills, 51,191. Aid workers killed, 444. Journalists, 72. Here is a snapshot of Afghanistan after nearly 20 years of U.S. occupation. The percentage drop in infant mortality rate since the United States, Afghan, and other allied forces overthrew the Taliban government, which had sought to restrict women and girls to the home, about 50. 50% is drop in infant mortality. Percentage of Afghan teenage girls able to read today that couldn't read before this, 37%. Oversight by Congress, you know, the people whose salaries we pay on both sides of the aisle. Date Congress authorized U.S. forces to go in after the culprits in September 11, 2001 attacks was September 18, 2001. The number of times U.S. lawmakers have voted to declare war in Afghanistan is zero. The number of times lawmakers on Senate Appropriation Defense subcommittees addressed the cost of Vietnam War during that conflict was 42. The number of times lawmakers in the very same subcommittee have mentioned costs in Afghanistan and Iraq wars through midsummer of 2021, same subcommittee, the number of times they talked about it was 5. The number of times lawmakers on Senate Finance Committee have mentioned costs of Afghanistan and Iraq wars since 2001 through midsummer of 2021. Now, this is the Senate Finance Committee. The number of times they mention it in 20 years? Once. This war was paid on credit, not on cash. It's not our cash. It's borrowed money. The amount President Harry Truman temporarily raised top tax rates to pay for the Korean War was 92%. The amount President Lyndon Johnson temporarily raised top tax rates to pay for the Vietnam War, 77%. The amount President George W. Bush cut taxes for the wealthiest rather than raise them at the outset of the Afghan and Iraq wars was at least by 8%. So was tax cuts. The other two presidents in the war in Korea and Vietnam, Johnson and Truman, raised taxes on the top percentage to help pay for this, to cover costs. President Bush dropped it by at least 8%. The estimated amount of direct Afghanistan and Iraq war costs that the United States has debt financed as of 2020, the amount of money we owe, $2 trillion. The estimated interest cost by 2050, up to $6.5 trillion with interest. With interest. It's a reminder that wars may end on paper, but they certainly don't when it comes to the cost on many levels. The amount estimated that the U.S. has committed to pay in health care, disability, burial, and other costs for roughly 4 million Afghanistan and Iraq war veterans is more than $2 trillion. Those costs will peak after 2048. So that's by the numbers. Those are things that I have not seen, quote, in the news. I don't watch the news a hell of a lot anyway, so I might have missed it. But I just felt that when you start getting down to the ledger and you start looking behind the headlines, you get down to this stuff, the cost of war in dollars is just one way to measure this. The cost of war, of course, in loss is immeasurable. It's immeasurable. And the big rally cry that I've seen, and I don't know even how to address it, if it could even be effective, are for those who not only gave all over there and their families, the Gold Star families, but those men and women who fought there and came back less than they were, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And so what do you say to them when they're sitting there knowing that they left a limb there, or their mind there, or their skin there, or their heart there in that war? 20 years. What do you say to them? What could you possibly say? Thank you for your service? It's become an effing bumper sticker these days. To me, it's like thoughts and prayers. It's just a passing mind fart at some point. And I think the expectation is somehow, well, we'll just get over it. And that's not the case. It doesn't work that way. If you've ever been in some traumatic event, you know that it stays with you for the duration. How you handle it, to a great degree, decides whether or not it handles you. And 22 veterans still take their lives every day. Every day. That's not on that list I read. And those 22 people who take their lives, that ripples out to their families and friends. And it is pain of the worst degree, of the worst compound interest you can imagine, of course. And so as I pull back on this, you know, again, for 3 days, I've been thinking, what could I possibly do to turn the microphone on to make any sense out of this? And this, I'm stumped. I mean, sure, it's easy to say thank you for your service. Oh, that's great. But thanking me for my service when I served in peacetime, flying in helicopters, is not the same as saying thank you to service to my cousin Rich, who was still pulling shrapnel out of his leg when he came home and has been battling Agent Orange all his life. It's not the same thank you for your service, or it shouldn't be for me. And any veteran worth their shit will tell you that. It's appreciated, but it's not the same. So I don't know how you even qualify this. And with the rally cry, as I mentioned, of people saying, you know, and messages are out there insisting that what these people did and what they gave their lives for because of the call of the country was worth it. And then you go behind the scenes and realize that the people that we paid to manage this shit don't even talk about it like we talk about it. And that's difficult to swallow. But it's the reality of it. It's the reality of it. Sergeant Ryan D. Jopek, United States Army, died August 1st, 2006, serving in the Operation Iraqi Freedom. He was 20 years old from Merrillville, Wisconsin, assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 127th Infantry Regiment, Wisconsin Army National Guard, from Waupun, Wisconsin. And I've been able to connect with his dad, Brian, over the last couple of years, two or three years, I guess it's been, through the internet landfill of Facebook, which for the most part is full of shit. But if you push some stuff aside, you can stay connected to people. And it's been an honor getting to know Brian a little bit. And it's not, I don't even know how he does this. I don't know how. You know, he just does. Meaning that enduring the death of his son, and Brian also served at the, you know, prior to his son going there, and he did his time in country. And, you know, I don't know how you do that. It is not within my experience, my scope. I have other experiences, and people look at me and go, I don't know how you came through that. Well, that's my experience. But this here is, especially these days, is never ending. But I wanted to mention Ryan Jopek because his name's not on that list specifically of all those that were killed in action. It's in there somewhere as a number, but his name was Ryan David Jopek. He was 20, and he died on August 1st, 2006, because he was asked to serve his country, and he said yes, and he went, just like his father did before him. Years later, in 2011, I was living in Michigan, and word got to me that my friend Greg Daniels, who I played a few years of semi-pro football with, and his wife Debbie Daniels, their son Nick, was killed while conducting combat operations in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. He was assigned to the 3rd Combat Engineer Battalion, 1st Marine Division, 29 Palms, California, and he was 25. When he was killed in action. And I have this vivid memory of driving down to Chicago after I heard about Nick, and who was just a little kid when I knew his dad when we played football together. But when I got to the funeral home, the sight was so overwhelming to see the honor guard outside and the people walking in silently, and the place was just filled with people. And I walked in and stood off to the side, and there was the casket up front with the honor guard on each side of Nick's casket. And I just sat there, once again thinking, until that you're in that situation, and even me standing just yards away going, this is a ripple effect that never ends. And maybe it's not supposed to, meaning that pain that's there is the reminder of what's been lost, and what's been lost is so sacred that it should be painful to some degree. There, of course, you're going to have mixed emotions, but at that particular time in 2011, this big man, offensive tackle, who I practiced against for a couple of years, 6'5", 280 pounds, mountain of a guy, when he came walking out from whatever room he was in, I didn't recognize him. He was hunched over and looked 1,000 years old, and my heart broke for him. And these days, when I see Greg and Debbie, it's at the bar on the rocks, and that bar was purchased with the death benefit, which those two words probably shouldn't be in the same sentence, death and benefit. Anyway, and it is a monument, really, to Nick and all the boys and girls that gave their lives there. It's a Marine bar. And you know, being a coastie, I'm surprised they effing let me in there, but they kind of let me slide, which is fine. Whenever I go there, it's the same sense to some degree that I had at the wake, that this pain will be here as long as this place is here and as long as we are here. And over time, as been mentioned, it gets less and less in the news. It's in the news now because there's people hanging off planes trying to get out of Afghanistan. But I can tell you, you know, it was since 1973, when I first saw that on television, and I couldn't make the connection to my cousin being in Vietnam and, quote, fighting for freedom, so, you know, the communists don't win, that whole thing of the decade of the 60s, and then watching the fall of Saigon and people, it just didn't add up. So for me, when I was watching this the other day, I thought, it's the same shit, different day. We just don't learn. We have to find ways, if at all possible, to bring people together. So this stuff, that's me, the only way it can happen. And I don't see it happening in my lifetime. The thing I do every day is get on the show called The Bridge. I co-host the show from here in Chicago with my co-host in Beijing, China. And the main reason I do it is to help bring the world closer together one conversation at a time, where we can start understanding each other a little bit, which may or may not be able to offset the shit that usually follows people who have different cultural backgrounds or beliefs. And my hope is that maybe something I've said or something in the conversation with them that I've had, that there's some value to people that they would look at the world a little bit differently. And maybe that offsets other things. Who knows? I have to live with that, because if I don't live with that, it's just Shit Creek. Shit Creek's old. There's no paddle. As I sit here for 3 days thinking, how the hell am I going to do this? Or should I do this at all? Should I just shut up and not say a word about it? Matter of fact, it's the third restart of the show. The first time I thought I had it, and that ain't it. Second time I got started, the guy fires up his lawnmower next door, so I've been waiting. He also had his weed whacker out. I almost killed him for that. But he survived. So this is the third attempt to make sense out of the senseless, and hopefully some of the obvious stuff buried in the absurd with those numbers. The expectation is we'll never have to go through this again. The reality is more than likely we will. Maybe it's not my lifetime. Maybe it is. I have no say over that. I've learned the greatest lesson is that it's all about response to events. I am not in a position to affect any world events, unfortunately, because a lot of shit would change. I'm here to tell you. But what I am in control of is my response to this. And when I think of how these veterans must feel that have put so much time, energy, and effort, and literally parts of themselves into this, how do they respond? How do we help them respond, if at all possible? So I don't know what you're going to take away from this. Could be nothing. Might be something. And it's not a bad thing to thank a veteran for their service, but these men and women for the last 20 years, that is above and beyond the call of duty, right? So think about it. 1 in 4 kids that are alive today have no idea why we were doing this. They weren't born. It's starting to diminish a bit, but we'll never diminish as I pour another shot or get another shot from Greg at the bar and we toast Ryan Jopek and Nikki Daniels. That'll never go away. No more than when somebody walks into that bar and we toast the men and women who gave their lives in Vietnam or any other war. Maybe in the end of this, as it's coming to my mind right now, that the only thing that can be done is the remembrance, because to be remembered is to be loved, and to be loved is to be remembered. And if we can do that in all of that, maybe that is the only saving grace when it comes down to it. I can't do a goddamn thing about what's going on in Afghanistan, but I can go to the bar and sit with my friend and listen. And finally, as the Greek philosopher Herodotus said a very, very, very long time ago, and unfortunately it still rings true today, in peace, sons bury their fathers. In war, fathers bury their sons. Until next time, safe travels. Be well. Adios.